Hey, before we begin, you know on this podcast we talk a lot about the best teams in the NBA, especially when one of those teams is the LA Lakers, which if my bosses had their druthers, I would talk about every second of every single day. But if you want to hear more about the inner workings of one of those teams, of those great teams, I've got two podcasts for you. The most recent episode of The Low Post features Lakers guard Danny Green, who talks about playing with LeBron James, what it's like playing against the top players in the league and being a teammate of Kawhi Leonard and more. And if you haven't listened to Wednesday's episode of the ESPN Daily yet, I strongly suggest you do, because friend of our podcast, Kevin Arnovitz, talks about the story that he did on Frank Vogel and his impressive first year at the Lakers. If you want to listen to either of those shows, you can subscribe to The Low Post and The Daily wherever you get your podcast. And now, on to our show. Hello and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. We talk about the NBA. Joining us, the A-team from Boston, Massachusetts. Massachusetts, yeah. Is Jackie McMullen. Hello, Jackie.
Hi, Brian. How are you today?
Joining us from Houston, where he is attending tonight's Rockets. Now I'm forgetting who they're playing tonight.
Rockets Nuggets.
Ooh. Rockets Nuggets.
I'm going Celts Grizz.
Yeah, Celts Grizz tonight. But I don't know if you're aware, but the only game happening tonight is in New Orleans.
It's true.
Very
true.
We are recording this on Wednesday afternoon. Jackie, yesterday you were in New York City, though, because you attended the David Stern Memorial, which took place at Radio City Music Hall. A lot of speakers. What did you take away from that experience?
Well, it's interesting. So you heard about all the big names. You know, Bill Russell was there, Oscar, Kareem, Jordan, Magic, Hakeem, Dikembe, Bill Walton was there, Jason Kidd. But what I thought was really cool, and those guys, by the way, all those, you know, A-team players, all-stars, Hall of Famers, if you will, there was one area that was roped off. And so they were sat in the front with a lot of the team owners. And, you know, Jeannie Buss was there. Billie Jean King gives you an idea of the breadth of, you know, the way David Stern touched the world. So those players, that's all well and good. But what really moved me a little more was all the players that showed up who weren't, you know, not flown in by their teams or by the NBA on a private jet, that made the effort to come on their own, retired players who are not household names. ML Carr was there. Otis Birdsong was there. Buck Williams, who should be a household name, and in my book is definitely a household name, came with his wife from Maryland. Tom McMillan was there. That's what impressed me, because those players, you know, everyone was looking to see where Magic was. Everyone knew, you know, Jordan would be there. But Chris Dudley was there. Those kind of players, I thought it was really cool that they came out to pay homage to a man who really did as much for them as he did for, even though he made it a superstar league, certainly all the increase in salaries and such benefited all those other players who were not perennial all-stars, who were not Hall of Famers, and who, you know, many of whom, you know, certainly are comfortable in their lives. But those were the people I talked with and enjoyed seeing. And then the other thing that was just very significant to me was that Yao Ming made the trip. We know that relationships between China and the U.S. are tenuous. And then beyond that, the relationship between the Chinese Basketball Federation and the NBA are extremely tenuous. And Yao is the figurehead and also the head of the Chinese Basketball Association. And he was there. He was there in the very front row, very prominently there and mentioned in a number of the speeches, and it was nice to see politics get put aside for a second during that day. The one last thing I would say is the women were well represented, as they should be, because I've told you guys before, David Stern was a great champion of women. Val Ackerman, I thought, gave one of the best speeches of the evening. She choked up a bit. You know, they worked very closely together, but, you know, Nancy Lieberman was there. I think I saw Ruth Riley there. There were a lot of WNBA players also milling about. So, you know, the only other funeral or wake or anything that I've ever been to like this was my late great friend Will McDonough, you know, the legendary sports writer for the Boston Globe. When he died, they held his wake in the Boston Garden. Think about that for a minute. And it was packed. And this felt a little the same. The amazing reach that David Stern had and how many people. It was a really cold day and how many people came out to pay their respects. It was pretty remarkable, really.
So I'm on the jump this week, and I spent some time talking with Rachel Nichols about the
Rachel
reason I couldn't. Yeah, the reason I couldn't attend was I hosted the jump for Rachel so that she could go out to New York. Her travel schedule's preposterous. She was in Houston for the ABC game over the weekend, then she went to New York for one day, and then she's going to Philly for this Saturday 76ers Lakers game. She's crazy. But
she is.
Jackie, she said the thing that moved her the most was the story that Rick Welts told.
Oh,
do
yes.
you remember that?
Yep.
Do you?
Oh, yes, very much so.
Now,
so
Rick Welts is the president of the Warriors, was previously the president of the Suns, but spent the most of his career working for the league office. Mm-hmm. And to set this up, he was the first openly gay lead NBA executive.
Right.
In fact, he just got married about 2 weeks ago. But obviously when he was working for the NBA in the 70s and 80s, he's one of the first few dozen NBA employees. He doesn't look like he would be that old, but he is apparently. Jackie, but he was closeted in the 70s and 80s and 90s. So
right, he was.
The story, if I guess that, just set that up.
Sure.
I assume the story that Rachel remembers is what you're going to tell here, what he told.
Well, absolutely. So Rick was one of David's right-hand men, but also was, took a lot of the brunt of his temper, his anger, his dissatisfaction, if you will, from time to time. But he was a closeted gay man who considered himself close to David Stern, but no matter how close he was to anybody in the league at that time, did not share with him that he had a partner whose name was Arnie Chin. And Arnie died in 1994. And as you can imagine, pretty devastating for Rick, and pretty devastating to go to work every day and not be able to talk about it with anybody because it's not something you've shared. And yet, he went out to Seattle for the funeral, the services, and he had put in the program or what have you of this service a little place where you could make a donation in memory of Arnie Chin. And when the services ended and he got on the flight back home and he took all the envelopes out of the bowl or wherever they were and was reading them on the plane, and he opened one up from Scarsdale, New York, and it was a $10,000 donation from Diane and David Stern. And he had never told David Stern that Arnie was his partner. He had never told David Stern he was gay. And he said that he actually still to this day doesn't know how David and Diane found out and made that donation. Important to note, I think, too, that Diane and David, most people know David Stern, but those who knew David pretty well, we all knew this. Diane was a force, is a force, and was very much influential in some of the decisions David made. She's a fierce environmentalist. An animal rights activist. She's a staunch Democrat and believes in doing the right thing. And I think she influenced David Stern greatly. And that really came out also during all of the speakers, including her two sons, who were very eloquent in talking about their dad as a guy in a suit behind the backstop watching them play Little League Baseball.
Well, I was thinking about this. How is the NBA going to commemorate? Like, unfortunately, the NBA is everything. Sort of has its name already. Sure there's been brainstorming. The Larry O'Brien Trophy is about a commissioner. The Bill Russell Trophy. A lot of the awards have names on them.
Mm-hmm.
How can they possibly commemorate him?
How about the David Stern Play-In Tournament?
Well.
Oh, gosh, I hope not. I was worried about this. Something to do with international basketball, because certainly that's one of his great legacies, is the way he expanded the game on a global stage. And I wonder if there's a way that you do something like that. Maybe it's attached to the USA Olympic team, but to me it could be bigger than that, because certainly...
Maybe something attached to the draft, because honestly, when a lot of fans think of David Stern, they think of... the guy shaking the hands for the first round picks up on the stage of the draft. And the draft, obviously, is as much of an international basketball event as anything could possibly be, probably outside the Olympics.
Yeah, that's a thought. I do think an international flair to something would, of course, the WNBA could rename anything and everything in their league after David Stern, because without him, they wouldn't exist.
Magic gave a very eloquent talk. He said that David was like his angel, that him, you know, getting him and allowing him to play in the 1992 All-Star game after he had had to retire a few months earlier saved his life. And mm-hmm. also the role that he played in getting him into the Olympics, you know, the following summer on the Dream Team, when there were people who just, you know, there were countries who didn't want to play against him. And it helped so much with awareness about the disease. So
right. He also left out that, you know, that when he came back, remember, he played in the All-Star game and then wanted to come back. And there was fierce opposition to that, all behind closed doors among owners and GMs. And as you guys remember, recall, some very much out in the open reticence among players. And David Stern just was like, nope, not in my league. If you want to start saying that my Magic Johnson can't play in my league, then I'm going to test all of you for HIV. Is that what you guys want? Are you convinced Magic Johnson's the only person with HIV in this league? Because I'm not. That's what he told them. And, you know, when David believed in something, boy, he didn't budge on it. And that was true with the WNBA. It was true with HIV and AIDS awareness and activism and some other not so savory things, as we know.
Right. All right. Well, we're appreciate you took the time to do that. Thank you. Back to the floor. McMahon, you're in Houston. Rockets are having a tough go of it. I think they've lost 5 of 6. James Harden is in the biggest shooting slump I can remember. I mean, he certainly, if he had bigger slumps in his career, it wasn't at this kind of volume, because he never played with this kind of volume earlier in his career. 1 of 17 on threes the other night against the Thunder. The Rockets have slipped to sixth, and the Thunder are kind of on their heels and have the tiebreaker right now for seventh. Things are not going well this season for Houston, which had very high hopes. I think the computers were expecting Houston to potentially get the number one seed. They liked what they did so much, and that is not the way it's gone. What's going on with the Rockets right now? And more importantly, is this a longer-term thing that the way they're assembled is not ultimately going to work?
Well, the problem with the Rockets, part of it is, if not now, then when? I mean, it's not built for the long term. There's a very kind of defined window, and so you better win now. And look,
James Harden is able to kind of serve as the Lysol for a lot of things that stink. But when Harden is shooting 24% from three-point range over a six-game span, they're probably not going to have a lot of success. You know, they might go 1-5. The fact that Harden is in this nasty slump certainly is a factor. But is it shocking that a guy who's right up the league lead in minutes and usage rate, and, you know, that usage rate is, you know, he has to work hard to get those shots and those passes. Is it surprising that he looks really tired midway through the season? I don't think it is. Is it surprising that P.J. Tucker looks like he's on fumes with all the minutes he plays, all that they ask of him defensively, you know, taking the toughest assignment, playing small ball center a lot? He's got a stinger now. You know, he keeps referring to it as nerve damage in his neck, his right shoulder, which is his shooting shoulder. You know, he's struggling to hit shots and really do anything else. And Eric Gordon. You know, the guy was awful to start the season, had knee surgery, missed 6 weeks. He's not in shape. He's not in rhythm. He's, you know, this season, one of the worst rotation players in the NBA. And that's a guy they're counting on to be their number three scorer, you know, to be whether he's the sixth man, which he is now, or a starter, to be a bona fide, you know,
Capella's
not all-star,
injury,
but big-time
right?
player.
Capella's got a heel injury.
You know, guys like Ben McLemore, Daniel House Jr., you know, they're relying on those guys, and, you know, they've never done it, and they're kind of reclamation projects or low-risk flyers in house that they, you know, did sign to a little deal this summer. They're a top-heavy team whose superstar is struggling. whose sixth man is struggling, who overall is a short, unathletic team. And then there's a lot of room for, there's a lot of potential for dysfunction. We've talked about this before from.
Yeah, they turn the ball over a lot and they don't get back on defense.
They're one of the worst.
Yeah, and that's a hustle and concentration matter.
No doubt. And, you know, those are also things that Russell Westbrook teams tend to struggle with, right? And even James Harden teams tend to struggle with. Like, the one silver lining right now is that Russ is playing really, really well. Like, he's putting up big numbers. He's doing it efficiently. And so
yeah,
that's
the silver
lining. He's averaging
32 and 9 assists over the last 6 or 7, I think.
Right, and shooting over 50% from the floor. Now,
yeah,
if you want to turn that on its head, you can say, well, boy, Russ is playing this well, and they can't even win. And, you know, the one thing I would shy away from is saying, well, when Russ is playing, you know, when Russ is putting up numbers, it really affects Harden. Harden can't get going. Now, look, he took 17 threes the other day. It's not like Russ is keeping him from getting shots up. And Russ isn't out there playing defense on him. And, you know, step-back threes with a hand in your face or step-back threes with a hand in your face, it's not like Harden relies on a certain kind of, you know, he needs space to do this and that. He's just struggling. But, man, it's you know, when Mike D'Antoni's talking about, well, if we walk by a window right now, a piano might fall out on us.
Great line.
It's a rough go.
Great line. Yeah. And, I mean, we've talked before, too, about the fact that D'Antoni's a lame duck coach. To me, mm-hmm. this doesn't feel like coaching, Tim, at all.
No.
It feels like...
And I did sniff around just because, like, look, lame duck, you have to at least ask around, like, is Mike in any kind of trouble here in terms of could there be a mid-season change? And nobody I've talked to sees that as anything but something that would create more problems. There's not like,
right.
you know, some interim coach who they want to, hey, you know, how will this guy do if he has his shot to run the show for the, you know, maybe he'd be the full-time guy. There's nothing like that. You know, they don't want to visibly press the panic button. And this isn't a situation, like, they're not blaming D'Antoni for this. You know, they hope D'Antoni can help with the solution. But in a lot of ways, the solution starts with Harden being Harden and not this guy who's just really in a bad spot right now.
But don't you think that's why so many of us were skeptical of the Rockets to begin with? Because the margin of error becomes so small when you rely on one player to do so much over the course of a very long stretch of a season, when you're playing with a bunch of guys who are undersized and, to your point, somewhat unathletic, for lack of a better way to describe it, who doesn't play well in transition defense. So to me, when you try to play that way, the margin of error is so small. It really is. Yeah, but the irony,
you don't have a lot of depth.
Right, and the irony of Oklahoma City with Chris Paul, former point guard for the Houston Rockets, thriving mm-hmm. quite nicely, should not be lost on anyone. They miss Chris Paul. I don't care what anyone says.
Yeah, I don't know if he could have had this season in Houston,
yeah.
though.
Well, I'm not saying that, though. But Chris Paul sets a tone, and not everyone always loves it, including James Harden. I get that. But he does demand you to play a certain measure of intensity on the defensive end. I mean, if everything else goes to hell for Chris Paul, he's always still going to bring that every night. And I think they miss it.
Yeah, and he's going to be locked in. He's not a take possession off guy. He's not a pick his spots guy.
Exactly.
You know, it's interesting.
Exactly.
After the loss to the Blazers, a double-digit loss to the Blazers, and it was a back-to-back for the Rockets, blah, blah, blah. Still, that's a non-playoff team coming into your house, beating you by double figures. Carmelo Anthony put up some numbers in that game. Damian Lillard played well. Russ is talking trash late in the game that you're losing by double figures, which is a terrible look, I thought. And it's like, Russ, you should never say another word to Damian Lillard in your entire life. He ended your whole career in Oklahoma City. But after that game, you know, I think sometimes team meeting sounds a little overblown, but there was certainly a discussion, an intense discussion, I would call it,
in the locker room afterwards, and Russell Westbrook was the one doing most of the talking and challenging guys, you know, got to play with energy all the time, this, that, and the other. And I haven't had anybody tell me this, but just put myself in the shoes of some guys who are sitting in that locker room, I personally would probably be thinking, man, Russ, I know you don't want to, but you sit out half the back-to-backs. We all played last night in Memphis. You didn't. You pick your spots defensively. Like, I know you talk a lot about energy, but you're very selective with your own energy. And I just don't know that if I'm one of those guys in the Rockets locker room, that Russ is the guy that I necessarily want to hear from. And it is interesting. Since then, after these last two losses, Russ has been like Mr. Pollyanna, like positive spin guy, to the point where after the Thunder loss, you have a 16-point lead in the going in the fourth quarter. 7 minutes left.
What a bad loss.
The doors blown off you in the fourth quarter. By the way, with Chris Paul sitting there, you know, coaching from the sideline and cheerleading for most of that time, saying, go get him, Schroeder, go get him, Gallinari, way to go, Gilgeous Alexander. Oh, Steven Adams was out injured. Terrence Ferguson, another starter, was out because of personal reasons. So you've got
Nerlens Noel was a slight scratch.
Yeah, so you've got the Thunder leftovers just torching you in your own house to steal that win. And Russ, after the game, I was kind of shocked when he said, it was a good game for the most part. I mean, obviously those last 6 minutes weren't the best, but hey, you know, we were in control for most of that game, you know, yay. Like, what in the world? So I don't know what's going on there, but.
Well, in recent years,
to go from challenging to.
Daryl Morey has never stopped tinkering, and even though it's kind of hard to improve during the season without trades, he's figured out various ways through buyout. Like last year, you know, maneuvered to get Austin Rivers, came up with Daniel House. Like he's sort of become known for, he's always been a constant tinkerer, but being able to, you know, scrape the bottom of the barrel and find corners and stuff to bring in guys, but he hasn't been able to do anything. I don't know what there is to do.
What can they do? How can they with this roster? I don't know.
Yeah. And look, it's always tough, when you don't have a whole lot of ammunition, and kind of the one little trade card that they tried to create, Nene, with that phony, you know, bonus-laden contract for a guy who's going to be hanging out in a hammock all season long, the league was like, no, dude, no, we're not letting you inflate his, you know, the salary that you can trade for a guy who's clearly on a minimum deal. So, you know, they don't have a whole lot of ammunition. Now, they still can trade a first-round pick. And certainly they're trying to. I mean, they would love to get Robert Covington from Minnesota. There's no question about that. You know, how exactly you build it. Basically, I don't know how you put the salaries together to go get them, but we like never underestimate Daryl Morey's spreadsheet ability. But yeah, not much ammunition other than trying to throw another first round pick out there. And, you know, and the problem there is this team has no young talent because they're always either throwing first-round picks at guys in trades or throwing first-round picks in to get off of contracts, you know, Ryan Anderson or whatever the case may be.
Right.
And then it gets back to this. Hey, might as well you got to go all in now. You've got a very defined window with Russ and James Harden on these max deals, and if we're looking 3 or 4 years down the road, it ain't going to be pretty in Houston. And, by the way, the problem that, well, I'm talking about, it's going to be like, I think it's going to be stripped down to the studs. If, you know, James Harden obviously talks about wanting to end his career in Houston and all that, I would be highly surprised if that actually happens.
Well, I mean, they're both on the books from that last, they're both 22, 23, they're both on the books for like almost $47 million each. How'd you love to be paying Russell Westbrook this year? Like almost $40 million, and he's shooting 23% from the 3-point line.
Well, you know? And look, Tillman Fertitta told a lot of people that he thought the Chris Paul contract was the worst that he had ever seen in business or sports, and then he traded him for Russell Westbrook.
Yeah,
what's the right. saying? Hold my beer.
Well, right. He didn't sign the Westbrook contract. He did sign the Chris Paul contract. So
Yeah, not that he had choice. That was basically agreed by the time he bought the team.
I agree, but he knew that when he bought the team. All right, moving on from
exactly.
that. I want to talk a little bit about Philadelphia. So they're playing a game tonight against the Raptors, and by the time you listen to this, that game may have already happened, and maybe they'll get beat by 30. I don't know. Maybe the Rockets will win by 30 tonight. But something's interesting happened in Philly. Joel Embiid went down with that nasty finger injury, and he's been out for the last couple of weeks, and the Sixers are 5-2 in that span, and in the first week he was out, Josh Richardson won Player of the Week. In the second week he was out, Ben Simmons won Player of the Week. If you've watched them play at all recently, and they've got a nice big game this weekend, like I said, with the Lakers on Saturday night, will be interesting to watch that for sure. The floor is spread for Ben Simmons. He is putting up, he's making all kinds of plays. He had a career high 34 the other night. He looks so comfortable out there. He's impacting the game more than he is before. Thibault has looked great. Richardson has looked great. Furkan Korkmaz has, you know, is stretching the floor with space beautifully. They just look better. And I'm not like, you know, we're talking about seven games so far, number one. And I'm not like pointing at Joel Embiid and saying he's hurting them. I just think it's what we've always known, which is that they don't, these pieces don't fit together. And, you know, the same thing could be said for Embiid. I think when sometimes when Simmons is out, when they can put a shooter out there and stretch the floor, he gets more space. Like, if I'm Sixers management watching this, like, your team doesn't play its best when you've got those two guys out there. Jackie, I don't, I'm not jumping to conclusions, but like, I don't know how you can watch the Sixers for the last 2 weeks and not notice how it unlocks their other pieces.
Well, it's simple, right? It's all about space. How do you space the floor? And when Joel and Ben are both on the floor together, they both want to be in the same area in the paint. Well, actually, Joel loves being behind the three-point line, but let's be real about where he's most effective. And that's in and around the paint, and that's the same thing with Ben. And so spacing is a problem. You know, it's funny when Pop came through town, he was talking about how he has those issues. You know, they don't have the three-point barrage, although they've been playing, you know, they've been having LaMarcus shoot threes and open things up for their team a little bit. And we know this. We've seen it over and over and over again. So does it mean one of them has to go? I don't know. Who would want to trade either one of these players?
Look, Elton Brand absolutely needs to go into the summer, or as the summer, you know, is rolling, determine what the market value is for both of those guys. What's the market value for Embiid? What trades are out there for Embiid? What's the market value for Simmons? Where can you move them? And he has to make a decision. He has to decide, are they building around Embiid or are they building around Simmons? Because, and I mean, unless they somehow miraculously click and make a run deep into the playoffs, at least into the East Finals. But I'm telling you, if they are out in the first or second round, that roster absolutely has to be remodeled. And I'm not so sure the decision won't be based on what you can get the better return on, unless they are just terrified of building around Embiid because of his health issues.
He's a great player. I mean, he's going to be an All-NBA player this year. He's going to be an All-Star starter. Like, I mean, yeah, he does have injury issues, but I can't say much bad about him. I mean, he's the dominant player in the game. I'm not commenting on Embiid. I'm just saying.
They're both great players, but they're great players who don't fit together. They're great players who get in each other's way. And again, I don't even think it's not like a,
you know, Kobe Shaq personality clash. Not that they're best friends and, you know, going out for hot chocolate together or anything, but it's not a personality clash as far as I can tell. It's the problem. It's that basically Joel Embiid has that sweet corner office right down there on the block. And Ben Simmons wants that office. He needs to operate in that same area, not necessarily as a post-up guy, but he needs that space to be cleared for him to operate. And just, you have to get the most out of one or the other. you have to have a certain kind of, you know, fit and spacing around them, and they just don't complement each other. They don't enhance each other's skill sets.
Dave, this week, David Fizdale's been here on TV, and Tracy McGrady as well, and we were talking about this, and, you know, Fizdale was basically, like, bringing out X's and O's and drawing on scrap paper and showing, like, how you could operate Simmons out of the high post and, you know, and Embiid out of the low post and how they could work together and force teams into you know, very difficult defensive decisions. But I realized, I go, that's 1990s basketball.
I
don't know if that applies.
Well,
you know.
The other thing is, I mean, the one thing that I've noticed in watching them since Joel's been out is they're just getting out and running. And that's when Simmons is at his best, let's be honest. You know, when you get him downhill and he's, you know, I mean, he's just, he's impossible to stop, really. And for some reason, that should still be able to happen with Embiid on the floor. But I think you just see an aggressiveness with Ben Simmons that just wasn't there when Joel was out there. And maybe that's as simple as sometimes players defer without even realizing it. You know, and certainly Simmons has put up big numbers. It's not like he wasn't scoring when Embiid was there, but there's just a different level of aggressiveness to him, an ease with which he's sort of taking over the game. And, of course, let's give some love to Furkan. He's had his moments, too, while the big man has been out.
Great games.
He really has. He's been really good. So,
we'll see. Just keep an eye on that situation. And I don't think it's a short-term decision. But, I mean, Elton Brand, first off, I'll say this about Elton Brand. He's not afraid to make any move. And so he's kind of fearless in that regard. And so as I think it makes it even more something he has to really think about, you know, not at this deadline, obviously, but as you mentioned.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, you said you don't think it's short term. Define short term, because I
don't think it happens in the next 3 weeks. I don't think you make a decision in the next 3 weeks.
I think it's a this summer decision, though.
Could be. Some decisions have to be made in the next 3 weeks back in your neck of the woods, McMahon. Terrible news for Dwight Powell.
Oh, what a shame. I love the way Dwight Powell plays.
One of those, sadly, just like the Durant injury.
You knew the second and a half. When he went down, you knew, oh, no, that's an Achilles.
Wow, and you can see it.
No contact, pushing off.
Yeah, but you can see in his calf, you can see the injury. Yeah. Just like with Durant, you can see the injury happen. So I'm glad for him that he signed the extension before the year, right? So he's protected financially. That's what I always worry about with role players who have this terrible injury. What was the extension for, McMahon? He picked up an option and then extended. Is that what it was?
3 years, $33
million. Okay.
That kicks in after this season, kicks in going and starting next season. So,
all right. So I'm at least happy for him on that front.
Right. People who – if you don't watch the Mavericks a lot, or honestly, even some fans who watch the Mavericks every day, like, you can't look at the box score and judge Dwight Powell's value to that team. He is an elite screen role guy, and that is where Luka is at his best. The Luka Dwight Powell screen and roll, and all the, you know, surrounded by shooters, open up the floor. Dwight's the vertical threat. You know, he's for this season and a couple seasons, two or three seasons before this, he's been elite in terms of efficiency, pick and roll finishing. It's like 1.35 points per possession. And like I said, just the respect that you have to give him rolling to the rim, all the shooters around him, Luka basically with the floor open has been, it's been historically potent and efficient. And obviously, they're going to miss that. Maxi Kleber can do that, but you got to be careful about pushing his minutes up too far. You know, playing Porzingis at center a lot is an option. But, you know, Porzingis just came back from 10 games off. His availability is always in question. Boban, you can't play Boban a whole ton of minutes, and there are certain matchups you can't play him
against,
period.
So, he's a niche player.
Yeah, so I mean, clearly.
So, I mean, they've been denying everything left and right, but I know that they've been looking for a perimeter player who had good size, who can score a little bit. They do have trade assets. They have a $12 million trade exception. They have Courtney Lee's contract.
They have the Warriors' second-round pick, which is a hell of a lot more valuable than anybody ever imagined it would be.
Almost certainly to be 31. Do they have to go out and get a big man now? Because this team, you know, they are going to be a playoff team, and they are going to be in a probably a highly contested first round series. Is this a situation where you go out and try to find a plug big man there to help you?
You know, I think you have to, like I said, I think you don't necessarily have to get a starting big man. And I would be absolutely shocked if they go hard after Andre Drummond just because he does not fit. He's not a good pick and roll guy. He's, you know, he's either a rebounder. There's not, you know, there's not a lot that he does right now that you would say, hey, that would really help the Mavs. And I think he'd be a poor fit next to Porzingis. I expect, you know, Rick will probably tinker with the lineups and try some things. He went small to start the second half with Porzingis at center and actually played Barea. Barea took Powell's spot and started the lineup. So that's, you know, going super small. I would expect Maxi Kleber will start and fill the Dwight Powell role. The problem is Maxi was playing a major, you know, really critical role in a lot of minutes in that second unit. So there's a hole there.
Right.
I just don't. You know, I don't think that they go and do something drastic that's going to have major long-term financial ramifications.
Well, the name that I thought of if they wanted to go for a significant player was Tristan Thompson.
Now, how much is left on his deal?
This is it.
Does he fit what they want?
See,
well,
I don't know.
He's a terrific pick-and-roll player.
He is.
He's not a classic basket defender, but he's a good switch defender. He's having a
See,
good,
that's
he's
more what they need running. because Porzingis is their rim protector. Dwight Powell was a center offensively who guarded power forwards. That's what Maxi Kleber does as well. That's to pair with Porzingis. That's what they need. They need a guy who can pick and roll offensively and guard power forwards.
I know there's some teams out there who think that I know the Celtics would be one of them who would love it if Tristan was bought out. I don't think the Cavs will buy Tristan out.
Keep him. That's not what I've heard. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they're going to, if anything, I think, you know, there probably would be some interesting, but they would probably, you're talking a first rounder minimum, right? I think you would try that. If you're Cleveland, I'm asking for a first rounder, whether you agree with that or
you
not.
Well, they're certainly asking for that Golden State pick.
Yeah.
You can't do, so I'm looking at him now, he's an $18.5 million expiring, so that, you know, with Courtney Lee and they could figure out, they could make the salaries work there. You know, that's interesting. Obviously they could easily go get Dwayne Dedman. Hell, they might even be able to get a pick back with him.
Yeah. The word I heard is that the Kings might have been pretty close to trading Dedman. And then he demanded to be traded, and they were like, actually, we're going to make you sit there for a little while.
We're going to keep you. Yeah.
That'll teach you.
Dedman only has $1 million guaranteed in the third year of that deal, $1.8 million, which would, you know, obviously Dallas is protecting 2021 cap space.
Right.
So,
yeah. Oh, well, that would help.
I thought a GM told me a few weeks ago that they thought internally the Cavs were even discussing extending Tristan Thompson. Have you not heard that, Brian?
I definitely think that Tristan is open to it. But the Cavs aren't going to do that until they see what might happen.
Yeah.
In a trade market. But Tristan wants
really
to
good.
Be there.
Right, and he's
Tristan
been good
has been
with the young guys. He's been really
yes,
good with
been
the
a,
young guys.
He's been a good soldier. And quite frankly, the Cavs have like $28 million in cap space this summer.
Mm-hmm.
Who are they giving it to? I mean,
right.
I mean, it's going to be hard
maybe,
for them.
The thing is, though, maybe you use that. Like, for example, the Grizzlies got that first-round pick with Iguodala. You can use cap space without... You know, you can use it in the trade market to collect assets, to collect
for
picks.
For sure. They just spent some of it on Dante Exum to pick up a couple of second-round picks from Utah. So, no, they definitely like that. But quite frankly, there's not a whole lot of demand for teams to clear space right now.
No, I hear you. Now, let me ask you this. If you're the Mavericks, do you call the Warriors and say, hey, Willie Cauley-Stein, obviously you don't need him the rest of the year. You guys aren't winning anything. You know what? I mean, he's at least an athletic finisher. Do you call the Hawks and say, Damian Jones or Alex Lynn, you know, we're not willing to give up a lot, but, you know, we'd like these guys to kind of be options off the bench, one of those guys to be an option off the bench.
Yeah, Willie Cauley-Stein makes nothing. He makes like $3 million.
I mean, yeah, two mil.
He's a, Yeah, okay.
And I'm sure the Warriors would be like, sure, give us take, back take their our pick second back. Round pick. And yeah. then Mavericks, yeah, how about the Jazzes that we own?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, I'll keep an eye on Dwayne Dedmon. I think Dwayne Dedmon is a good candidate to be moved. And I do think that you're going to have to incentivize it because he's not played at all. And I saw Bobby Marks today after they finalized that Trailblazers trade today. I think Bobby pointed out that the Kings have 14 second-round picks in the next six drafts. So it wouldn't surprise me if Dedmon is moved and you attach a second-round pick to him because he signed a $40 million contract. It's not fully guaranteed, but he signed a pretty big contract.
Right. I mean, the Kings have a lot of money tied up in like Buddy Hield and Harrison Barnes. You could see where they might... You know, I mean, that's a small market team, right? So, and mm-hmm. you know, De'Aaron Fox is the guy you're going to pay next. So you could see where some of those guys might, I mean, would they
Well,
try,
they've got the Bogdanovich contract
right,
coming up this
well,
summer, too.
Say,
that's right.
Yeah. Don't you move him at the deadline?
Well, I tell you what, he is a guy, and this is getting completely off the, hey, how do you kind of stopgap the center position for the Mavericks? But Bogdanovich is a guy who I do think the Mavericks would have significant interest in, and he is really close with a gentleman by the name of Luka Doncic.
Well, I would trade for him. I would go after him. I think we haven't.
I think he.
Seen,
I don't think he has
the surface.
Yeah, I don't think he has a problem playing in Sacramento. Like, I don't think he's unhappy, but I think he realizes with the amount of money they have in Hield and Harrison Barnes and De'Aaron Fox, there, he's not going to be probably even a star starter.
Right.
And,
you know, so not only does he want to get paid, but he'd like to have a big role. And while I have heard rumblings of a bunch of teams who want Bogdanovich, I have not heard any rumblings that the Kings are interested in actually trading him. So,
yeah, I've heard that they want to keep him, but we'll see.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he was unbelievable for Serbia. He was like, it was incredible.
But this is one of the reasons when teams have players that are tradable. You know, if you have an Andre Iguodala, if you have a Tristan Thompson, if you have, mm-hmm. you know, whomever, there is a desire to wait towards the deadline because there are injuries and things that happen that change
sure.
the market. The center market, because of Powell's injury, has all of a sudden changed. So there's still time between now and the deadline. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening to the Hoop Collective podcast. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Jackie. Hope everyone has a great week. I, for one, am hoping to see greatness from Zion tonight. Doesn't have to be 30 points because he's not going to play that many minutes, but I'd like to see some good stuff. It'd be good for the NBA, so I am very anxious to see that, and we'll be talking about that, I'm sure, coming up over the weekend. I think we're scheduled. I don't want to be too close to not lock this down because things can change, but I think we're going to possibly have the debut of our New Orleans beat writer, Andrew Lopez, to talk about Zion.
Andrew does a very fine job. So. I'll tell you, all Zion has to do is get on the floor and not trip, and everyone's going to go bonkers. He has a chance to own that city. He has the personality for it. I believe he has the skill set for it. You know, think about their past superstars. Not super dynamic, right? Mm-hmm. Anthony Davis, dynamic player, not a dynamic personality. Chris Paul, we all know, you know, he has his... This kid could own that city. And what a city that would be to own, huh? I think it would be so great.
Chris Paul,
said. Well, I just mean that he's a reticent personality. Let's put it that
we
way.
We know.
No,
Zion has the potential to own that city as a power forward / pass rusher. I mean, he could do double duty for all the Benson sports.
Could
properties.
He be the Drew Brees of the Pelicans? I think he can. I think he's got the personality for it.
All right, thanks, guys. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.